Hello, and welcome to the next installment of the Keter Shem Tov Chabura. Lately, in this past fall, we have been examining the rituals of the weekday prayers, Shacharit, Mincha, Arvit, what is done at various points in these rituals. That's what's going to drive the intellectual thrust of our examination through December. However, we have said that when a holiday comes up, we will take time away from that schedule to examine a Jewish holiday, the relevant one, which in this case is Hanukkah. So unlike our usual sessions, this one will be about the holiday of Hanukkah. It happens in America that the famous American holiday of Thanksgiving is coinciding with the Hebrew holiday of Hanukkah, and this has produced a lot of attention focusing on the relationship between the two of them. Now, that's a little bit trendy, so I don't want to overdo it, but I do think that it's worth exploring a little bit the origins of these two holidays to be able to compare the substance of the supposition that the two are in fact related. So really it's a way of the proposed relationship between them that is being talked about in the blogosphere, so to speak, as a way for us to examine critically in our text the origin stories of these two holidays. I think for the purposes of this Chabura, which is focused on Torah, it would probably be best to spend the majority of our energies focusing on Hanukkah itself. So that's what we'll do for probably the first more than half of this shiur, is just look in our text at where Hanukkah came from. I imagine that I'll end up having to gloss over a little bit the sources on Thanksgiving, but you'll have them in your sheet and you can read them on your own. And finally, at the end, we'll look at a series of articles that's been going around and references that have been going around on the internet about the idea that Hanukkah and Thanksgiving would not again coincide until the year 81,056. I think this number is somewhat dubious, and I think actually the intent of the person who is behind the article suggesting that number in the first place was aware that it was dubious and that he was actually trying to make a point about the state of the modern Hebrew calendar. So what we'll do primarily in the first more than half of the shiur is examine the origin stories of Hanukkah, followed by a glossing over of the origin stories of Thanksgiving, so that we can then get to the end piece about the Jewish calendar and the next time that Hanukkah and Thanksgiving will coincide. So the first thing that we have here is Hanukkah and the Mishnah. And those of you who are familiar with this issue, where is the Hilchot Hanukkah in the Mishnah?
Shabbos.
Okay, we have a guess for Shabbos.
Oh, it's in the Gemara Shabbos.
Okay, Gemara Shabbos, but in the Mishnah?
Is it mentioned in Megillah?
I'm not going to look on the page.
Pardon? Ben's looked already. So yeah, yeah. Okay. So
is it by any chance?
Pardon? By any chance, it's not there. Meaning that there's no discrete area that, say, Hilchot Rosh Hashanah, or there are many areas of Halacha which have their own section of Mishnah, or they're in a few different places. Look here and here, and you'll find them all together. In the Mishnah, it's a little weird. There are only seven Mishnayot that even mention Hanukkah, and we're now going to read one or two of them just to see what is that actually like. And I've added these explanations in Rashi script are my addition based on a summary of the Kehati. If it's in Rashi script, it's not part of the Mishnah. Joel, go for it.
Sure. Bikurim Aleph Vav. Bikurim Chapter 1, Mishnah 6. Hakoneh shte ilanot betoch sadeh shel chavero mevi bikurim ve'eno koreh. The one who acquires two trees within a field of his friend, so he goes to his friend's field and buys them, he brings bikurim, first fruits, and he does not pronounce, this is the special bracha, the blessing, the things that are said over doing first fruits.
It is a rote text that is recited from the Torah.
Arami Obed Avi.
You got it.
Yep. Rabbi Meir says, Mevi Bekore. He disagrees and he says, you do, when you bring them, you do say that text. Yavesh Hame'ayan.
Yavash.
Yavash Hame'ayan. A well dries up. Shehailan chai mimenu, o, that the tree is raw from it, or lives?
The tree lives from it. So
The well dried up that was giving water to the tree.
Exactly. Or.
Or, nekatsetz ha'ilan, cuts down the ilan, the tree is cut down.
Right.
Meviva eno kore. So if it died by either being cut down or by having its water source cut up, you bring and you do not recite that text. Rabbi Yehuda, and that was all Rabbi Meir. Rabbi Yehuda's opinion, Rabbi Yehuda Omer, Meviva kore. He says, even in that case, you bring and you still recite the text.
Right, just one little tweak. I think we're back to, we have an anonymous statement in which Rabbi Meir adds something, and I think we're back again to an
Yavash HaMayan is not Rabbi Meir.
Right, and then okay. Rabbi Yehuda attaching an extra opinion.
And he says, bring and do pronounce. Me'atzeret ve'arachag. Mevi vekore she'en kriya ela bizman shel simcha, from the holiday of Atzeret until Chag, which is Sukkot. Chag is Sukkot.
Yeah,
right. Yes.
And yeah. Atzeret is
Shavuot.
That's okay. Thank you. From Shavuot until Sukkot, you bring and you recite the text, and it says in the parentheses that we only read in the time of Simcha. We only read this. Pronouncement when there's a time of joy, like these chagim.
But it's a period of time between them, right? So it's the period of time in which there's more light and more produce, agricultural produce. So we're rejoicing in that that period of the year as a happier time.
And then minachag ve'ad Chanukah meviva eno kore. And from Sukkot until Chanukah, we bring and we do not pronounce the special thing in the Torah. Rabbi Yehuda ben Batera Omer Meviva Kore, and Rabbi Yehuda ben Batera says that we bring and we read that special thing.
Right, so what are we going to learn about Chanukah from this?
It exists.
Okay, very good. So
within the context of Bikurim, temple.
Right, and it seems to be related to Simcha in some fashion. Due to, in this case, the lack of simcha. It's until Chanukah is not considered a happy period. So maybe Chanukah would reinvoke the happiness. But that so we learn, A, that it exists, and B, something about its relationship to happiness.
And I would say that it has enough significance, whether halachically or just as a holiday, that it can be used in a Mishnah to set calendar dates.
Right. So I think for the sake of time, let's not read the one from Rosh Hashanah. The Ayin Ode that's there is the other cases in which Chanukah is mentioned in the Mishnah, all of which are of this type, sort of mentioned min hatzad. So the next question then is, why is that? And we have different answers, one of which is Keter Shem Tov, and one is Rav Nisim Gaon. So we'll see. It's a very interesting question. Why isn't it crowned with its own spot in the Mishnah? Ben, take it away.
Madua ein Chanukah nimsat min Mishnah chutz mi kama kama haskarot min hatzad.
That's just my gloss.
Why the only why is Chanukah mentioned in the Mishnah? Other a few side comments. Kedush Yom Tov, volume 2, page 517. Madua no lo timsa muska nitzachon hamakav the Maccabees the Mishnah or the Gemara v'rakuska v'ksuvim achronim u'tfilas alhanisim. Why is it that the great achievement, the victory of the Maccabees, is not mentioned, is not found in the Mishnah or the Gemara, only mentioned in the Apocrypha and in the prayer of Al-Hanisim? Tam, shelo huzker b'mishnah b'gemara, nitzachan ha-Maccabeeim, shigam milchamo tam. The reason the victory and the wars of the Maccabees are not mentioned, hayo derech neis kiadua, because this is, which was in the way of a known miracle. Kazav Abudraham, the Abudraham writes, V'af alpi, she hayu chashmonai uvanav chasidim v'anshei masa, even though the Hasmoneans were pious people and men of action, lachu lahem hamelucha, they took for themselves the melucha, the kingship, shlo ge hogen shehem hayu kahanim, but which was not appropriate for them, because they were priests. But Kohen ein lo chelek b'malchus, and the priest does not have a share in the kingship. You know, as the pasuk in Devarim says, "Leman yarich yamim al mamlachto," in order that you should extend your reign should be extended on the kingship. V'samach lei lo ye lekohenim halavim, and then nearby it says it shouldn't be is not for the Kohen, the Levim, the priests, and the attendants.
Right, so basically this is learning out the Devarim Yod Zayin Kaf, that's the last pasuk in Perek Yod Zayin. The very next pasuk is the first pasuk of Yod Chet, which is talking about something else. But if you read the end of the previous pasuk in light of the beginning of the next pasuk, it would seem that a mention of Malchut is followed up immediately with Lo Yiyeh LaKohanim HaLevim. That shouldn't be for the Kohanim. So it's not apparent from the pasukim other than their position.
Smichas ha-pasukim.
Right.
Lefi she'ataro ba'atara she'ena shelahem soviv habora yisbarach. And therefore it follows, according to this, that this ateret, this splendor, it's a splendor which is not for them. The God has not given it to them. V'kam Herodos?
Yeah, the King Herod.
Ah, and also King Herod, Shehaya Eved Mi'avdei Chashmonai, who was one of the servants of the Chashmonaim. V'kala Es Zaram, and married into?
He destroyed.
Oh, he destroyed. Their descendants. Lo ha sha'ir mehem srid and upalit, and didn't leave any remainder behind.
There, which is a story that's actually told in the Gemara of how he does that.
Ayin sham. Umishum hachi matza lenachon Rabbeinu HaKadosh. So because of this, it seemed good to, you think proper to Rebbe, to Rabbi Yudan Nasi, lahashmit nitzchonam legamrei mishnah to, to remove or to exclude this whole miracle of the Chashmonaim from his Mishnah.
From our Mishnah, Mishnah Teinu. So it seems that he would have put it there, Lichora, except that because of their improper contact, improper conduct, there we go, that he didn't want to honor that conduct with eternal memorialization in the Mishnah. All right, so the next thing, I don't know if you've ever looked in the Vilna Shas. In this part of the Vilna Shas. And if you open up the front page, it says you have the beautiful gate with the Masechet Brachot Min Talmud Bavli, and you flip it over, and on the back side is all the sources they use. And then there's one double-sided page with two columns of tiny font. They're just itty-bitty. I have the huge 16-inch-tall Gemaras, and it's still really small in that. There is a lovely introduction to the Talmud and the Mishnah by Rav Nissim Gaon that is crammed into that teeny tiny space. And unfortunately, I think because of the presentation, people tend not to read it. But he addresses the origins of the Mishnah. And even though it's a little bit of a sidestep for what I'm ultimately trying to talk about, I just loved what he said so much that I would like very much to read it now. And anytime you see a dot, 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 he writes in these long run-on sentences, and I just I had to be Mekatzer at some point. So this is selections from that introduction.
Okay. Aval ava er hazman asher nichtava bo ha-mishnah v'gam ha-tamud. I will explain the time during which the Mishnah and Talmud were written. V'omer lo sarah ha-kabbalah v'masura mishumeret v'in ha-ma v'chasher haya ha-adam korev v'asu lahem tzitzit haya omer ki ze ha-tzitzit hi tzitzit. Nasim otam v'knaf ha-talit nisparchu te'achet v'yesh bo ha-ksharim. So I will say that the tradition and the way it was passed down did not cease being kept among the people. And when a person read the verse, make for yourself tzitzit, he would say that this is tzitzit, and we'll put it on the corner of the garment, and it has eight strings, and they have five knots. And he would know automatically all the secrets of the tzitzit.
Just from those three words.
V'inyaneha haya shamur etzlo, and all of its matters were kept with him. Hakol v'kabbalah v'masoret, everything the way that it was transmitted and passed down. V'chen kol mitzvot kulan. Kasher ayu korin oto hayu yodin l'chama inanim mitchaleket kol mitzvah v'mitzvah. And so with all the other mitzvot, when they read them, they would know all the many matters that belong to each and every mitzvah. Mount Hatamia Pitaron and what is under the solution, the explanation. Aval Davar Shahaya Ausin Koit Vait, Kamoham Lachot Vahiv Modim Vahilat Hatamun Vahaliya, Lone Alama Fiu Meha Nashim Vahiv Meha Vadim. But the things that they did all the time, like work and the holidays and eating cooked foods and
the aliyah is the tail fat.
Those matters didn't leave even the women and the slaves. Ki kol yom hen roino to oto inyan va yo sino to bgo sara ha ma min a min hag mi mo moshe va anachar korban vayit shedi be kufnun shana bimei Rabbi Yehuda nasi. Because they saw those things every day, and they did them, and they didn't pass, and this practice didn't pass from the people from days of Moshe until after the destruction of the Second Temple in the 150th year. I'm not sure exactly what that refers to. During the days of Rabbi Yehuda Nasi, Asher Nikra Rabbi, who was called Rabbi. And when he saw the transmission, I guess, of the people was becoming poorer and missing in reading and in wisdom, and he saw what happened to the people through the decrees and the burden. And his days were days of deliverance to bring him close from the king. It came to his mind, or came upon his heart, that he would gather everything that they had in their in his hands through the transmission. He saw dispersion would be very long. He gathered with the wise ones of his generation and gathered the principles to the people of that time to keep them as a sign. And he made a great establishment and beautiful one, and he created a or put together a great work according to his wisdom and his deductions, and he called it a Mishnah. And afterwards, his students Rabbi Chia and Rabbi Oshaya made the Tosefta, which has addition of explanation and solution. But the essence is from the Mishnah. And from the conclusion of the Mishnah till the close of the Talmud was 280 years. And they wrote down the Talmud because they saw that also the people were becoming fewer, and they were missing more, and they needed to be guided on the path. And he brought them close to the matters and explained everything, so they wouldn't have to labor so much.
All right. So this doesn't mention Hanukkah directly, but I think he really lays his heart on his sleeve when he says, "What's the point of the oral Torah?" Which I think is very interesting. So given what he says the oral Torah is for, what do we think his theory about why the Mishnah doesn't mention Hanukkah would be? First of all, what is his view of the Oral Torah based on that paragraph?
As Rabbi Linzer says, he's like of the Rambam school. He's of the, it's all tradition. It's all passed on. It's not about deduction, not about human deduction to understand the laws. It's about passing down the tradition.
Right. And it's also about shichachat hadorot. He says, I don't think it's a dig at women and slaves at this time. He's just saying that women and slaves had a lower social status in the society of the time, And in his view of the sort of great olden days, the Jewish law was so well known by everyone that even people of a lower social order were completely familiar at a level that the greatest male scholars today would only hope to approach. And the reason for writing down the Mishnah is that we were persecuted and we had Shichachat HaDorot and the sort of deterioration of nations and the weakness of transmission. And so he thinks that's why we need the Mishnah. And when we have the Tosefta, the point is to clarify some things that were later not so clear in the Mishnah. When we have the Gemara, it's to clarify some things that were not so clear.
It was almost a rush job in some ways.
I don't know about a rush job. That's something you slap together quickly because you need it right now. Where I think it's like a preservation. It's like you're juggling 100 balls and you can't catch them all. So you make a bucket, and it catches everything. And so I would say that from this you can deduce that his view is that everyone reading the Mishnah and who would see these seven mentions of Hanukkah would say, and it's about the story of the Chashmonaim, and we light candles, and there's different traditions about how many and which side, and you would be able to read those seven things and instantly know. And the fact that it has to be then spelled out in the Gemara is because people start to forget. And he assumes that it was there all along. So I don't want to weigh in on which of them is right or even whether there are, in fact, more opinions about this. But what I will say is that the fact that it's not in our classical sources makes the origins of the holiday of Hanukkah very foggy. And we have some different explanations about what's the reason for that fog. Is it a religious punishment reason for pride of the Kohanim, or is it a preservation thing or something else? That it's hard to know the origin of Hanukkah. And I think when we're all this energy is being spent on the association of Hanukkah with Thanksgiving, it is important to look in the origins, which is a lot of why I'm focusing on them so much in this shiur. So let's move on and see, now that we did have the Talmud and we did write it down, what does the Talmud actually say, Ben?
Well, so just to make a point, of course, the Mishnah was composed edited about 200,
right,
which is about, and the Chashmonaim are 200 years before the Churban.
Right. So that's, it's already 400 years later.
That's right. So,
right.
So even if it'd been in the Mishnah, there's still a fair chunk of time away from,
that's right,
the event. So the fact that it's in the Gemara, you know, okay, that's a bit further. But
right. And if you accept the Reish Pei Shana argument of Rav Nissim Gaon, which is debatable, but nevertheless, if you accept that, then Ribi was closer to the completion of the Talmud than he was to the story of Hanukkah.
Yeah.
Right? That would be another way to powerfully make the point you just made.
Well, maybe if you use Rav Nissim Gaon's idea to feed back into Keter Shem Tov, maybe they wanted us to forget some of the nitty-gritty that happened behind it.
So the point of Hanukkah is it's not a historical holiday. It's
right.
About the meaning,
yeah,
of Hanukkah. Oh, so now we got to get to what the meaning is. So let's see. I thank you, Joel, for reminding me that Keter Shem Tov was, in fact, right. They never mentioned the Maccabees. Here they mention the Hasmoneans in this text. But this is the one little four-line text in the Gemara that does mention military victory.
Okay. Shabbat 21b. By Hanukkah. What is Hanukkah? Ditani Rabbanan, as our rabbis taught, the Chafhei B'Kislev, Yomei de Hanukkah, Timni Inun.
Timania
Inun. So on the 25th of Kislev, the days of Hanukkah are 8. Delo lemesaved behon velo lehit anot behon. So you're not supposed to give a eulogy, and you're not allowed to fast on it. Shenechneso yevanim lehechal ta'amo ko hashmanim shebehechal. So when the yevanim went into the sanctuary, they made all of the oil impure. Uchishegavar malchut be. So, and when the group of the Chashmonaim were stronger and they were victorious, but ku v'lo matzu, so they searched and they could not find ela pach echad shel shemen shemunach munach b'chotamo shel kohen gadol, that they found one cruse of oil that had the seal of the kohen gadol on it. And they only had enough in it to light for one day. shmona yamim, l'shana, and there was a miracle. It lasted 8 days. L'shana acheret kavum ve'asom yamim tovim behala behoda. And the next year, they established for themselves Yom Tov and Hallel and Thanksgiving.
Okay, so what's the...
Thanksgiving.
Yes, Thanksgiving. That's our first mention of why these two holidays actually belong together, or why they might, Lichora, and why everyone is making a big deal out of it. And so we do have a very bald story. There was a military victory. There was the miracle of the oil, and this Tosafot HaRosh, which we can skip, brings the interesting question, you know, if it lasted for 8 days, but there was enough for day one, what are some different ways that you can say that the first day actually was also a miracle? Because
famous
if
question.
You, I'm pardon?
The famous question, why
yes.
It's kind of 8 days long.
That's right, and not seven, because if you only had enough for one day, then only the remaining seven are miraculous. And a little bit from Arachin, which we'll also skip, just talks about why is it that Chanukah is red that Hallel is red, thank you, on Chanukah, and the answer being that it's because of giving thanks for the miracle and for having been saved. So let's now turn to another source. This is actually the Book of 1 Maccabees, which is a book that Jews like to read because we think it's interesting, but we don't think that it's part of the Bible. It was written in Greek, and it seems to have been written by a Jew. So it does tend to take the Jewish point of view, but we did not canonize it, and we don't have any holy status. But it's an interesting way of looking at the history. And Joel, actually, do you mind if I pass
Happy
the
to.
Reading on to you?
Starting from chapter 1.
Yeah. So first we just introduced Antiochus, who he is, and that he took over Jerusalem. And then.
Yeah. Antiochus, a plundering of both Jerusalem and the temple. Chapter 1, starting at verse 41. Then the king wrote to his whole kingdom that all should be one people, and that all should give up their particular customs. All the Gentiles accepted and the command of the king. Many even from Israel gladly adopted his religion. They sacrificed to idols and profaned the Sabbath. And the king sent letters by messengers to Jerusalem and the town of Judah. He directed them to follow customs strange to the land, to forbid burnt offerings and sacrifices and drink offerings in the sanctuary, to profane Sabbaths and festivals, to defile the sanctuary and the priests, to build altars and sacred precincts and shrines for idols, to sacrifice swine and other unclean animals, and to leave their sons uncircumcised. They were to make themselves abominable by everything unclean and profane, so that they would forget the law and change all the ordinances. But many in Israel stood firm and were resolved in their hearts not to eat unclean food. They chose to die rather than to be defiled by food or to profane the Holy Covenant. And they did die. Very great wrath came upon Israel.
Right, so it's a very... this is why I picked you, because you have a great dramatic reading.
Thank you.
But what it says is that Chanukah functionally is all about Shmad. And when people talk, you hear it, there's a certain camp that dislikes the... cultural Christmasization of Hanukkah, making it all about gifts and decorations and so on, because in a sense it's that camp would say that's like accepting the culture of another, and Hanukkah is about celebrating your own culture. So this is one of the things that people might point to in that point of view. So Joel, since you're so good at these dramatic readings, take it away.
Sure.
I cut out a lot of stuff, so that's what the square brackets say what happens in the meantime.
Sure. And in that section, there was revolt, there was defeat and victory, rebuilding and reconsecrating the temple. So good things now. Chapter 4, verse 52. Early in the morning on the 25th day of the ninth month, which is the month of Chislev, in the 148th year, they rose and offered sacrifice, as the law directs, on the new altar of burnt offering they had built. At the very season and on the very day that the Gentiles had profaned it, it was dedicated with songs and harps and lutes and cymbals. All the people fell on their faces and worshipped and blessed heaven who had prospered them. So they celebrated the dedication of the altar for 8 days and joyfully offered burnt offerings. They offered a sacrifice of well-being and a thanksgiving offering.
So there we have it again.
They decorated the front of the temple with golden crowns and small shields. They restored the gates and the chambers for the priests and fitted them with doors. There was a very great joy among the people, and the disgrace brought by the Gentiles was removed. Then Judas and his brothers and all the assembly of Israel determined that every year at that season, the day of days of dedication of the altar should be observed with joy and gladness for 8 days, beginning with the 25th of Kislev.
All right, so what's Hanukkah about according to this account then? What does it celebrate?
The rededication of the temple.
It's Hanukkah Habayit, right? What's a noticeable absence from this account?
War.
I cut out the war. That was my thing.
The miracle story,
right? So the thing that the Gemara most celebrates, and that the Rishonim are at pains to make sure that we understand how miraculous the
was not important enough to put
it
here.
Was not important enough for the author of this text to even include it.
And, wasn't important
and,
to him.
Yeah, it's all about rededication. Although it's interesting because we do, nevertheless, we still call the holiday Hanukkah, evoking the language of Hanukkah Habayit. And what the text does bring out is that just as the temple was profaned on the 25th of Kislev, so too it was rededicated, a nice poetical book ending, you going from persecution back to the restoration of normalcy. I think we do have this piece represented, but we tend not to talk about it as directly in our text. And just in terms of bringing up the celebration of war, it's a little gruesome, but let's have the chapter 7 reading and see what comes of this is not the end of the story yet.
Sure. Sometime later, this is chapter 7, starting at verse 43. So the armies met in battle on the 30th day of the month of Adar. The army of Nicanor was crushed, and he himself was the first to fall in the battle. When the armies saw that Nicanor had fallen, they threw down their arms and fled. The Jews pursued them a day's journey, from Adassa as far as Gazara. And as they followed, they kept sounding the battle call on the trumpets. People came out of all the surrounding villages of Judea, and they outflanked the enemy, so that they all fell by the sword. Not even one of them was left. Then the Jews seized the spoils and the plunder. They cut off Nicanor's head and the right hand that he had so arrogantly stretched out, and brought them and displayed them just outside Jerusalem. The people rejoiced greatly and celebrated that day as a day of great gladness. They decided that this day should be celebrated each year on the 13th of Adar. So the land of Judah had rest for a few days.
This day is actually called Nicanor's Day. It was a real holiday. Apparently, according to the... I think it's the New Oxford edition of the Bible. It says that it was celebrated up until the end of the Second Temple period. Mm-hmm. Now, given what you may know from other Jewish sources that I haven't brought, what might this kind of text and the existence of this holiday make you want to say? You might say, but, and fill in with some, so yeah, Gabe's got
what happened to Tiny Duster?
I'm sorry?
What happened to Tiny Duster?
Tiny Duster. Well, yeah, so there's that, right? But also in terms of meaning of holiday, I hadn't even thought about the Tiny Duster, but that's a great problem. But in terms of the meaning of the holiday, we have all these midrashim about Maasei Yadai Tovim Bayam Vatem Sharim Shirav. We have a lot of texts in which we downplay the celebration of death.
Tiny Duster is Mamash and Minhag.
That's true.
Ah, so that's the answer.
But did it exist at that point?
Probably not.
Historically, that would also be a very interesting question. But the point is that we tend not to like celebrating death. And in fact, I would say Esther is Davka, the holiday that people like to point to as a proof of that, right? Or the Purim, rather. Because everyone says we don't celebrate on the 13th. We celebrate on the 14th or the 15th, depending on where you live. And that's it's celebrating the peace that was restored after the military victory, not the military victory itself. Well, so according to this non-canonical source, there's some evidence that, in fact, on the side, outside of the intellectual realm of those texts, that people were also celebrating death, or the military victory, war, was being commemorated in a festival. So now, I always like to make my little plug for Birnbaum. I grew up with the Siddur of Paltiel Birnbaum in Urbana, Illinois. Once upon a time, that was the Siddur of the whole Kehillah. And he includes in it Megillat Antiochos, which is a text that exists in Aramaic and Hebrew. It seems the original was in Aramaic. And it also seems to have been composed by Jewish authors. I think it's only 72 Pesukim? No, 8. Well, I have 73, so it I forget the number of Pesukim, but it's short. And the note in the Birnbaum Siddur says that it actually was read liturgically in Italian synagogues in the Middle Ages. So it has some kind of Jewish status, enough that he would feel comfortable putting it in the Siddur. But again, it's a non-canonical text. Yeah.
So Joel and I actually, we were learning, no, it was Ben and I who were learning yesterday. Must be tired. Found out that Verma might have put it in because it was in the Beresidor, actually.
Oh, interesting. So he was copying Maasai Avot. You know, the authors of the Vilna Shas point out that the first people to include the Tosefta in the back of the Gemara was the Bamberg Press, and they say we don't know why they did it, but it happens to be that every subsequent publication has also done that. And it's weird, because Lichora, it ought to go right after the Gemara in terms of historical continuity. So they said, we've put it in the back so that if you want, take it to a binder and have them stitch out that part. You can bind it all in a distinct Tosefta volume, and you can read them side by side. so it seems like they're just like, we can't stop copying Maasai Avotenu, but if you find that that's weird, rebind it on your own dime. so at any rate, this is what it says. I'm just going to read for the sake of time. I'll read a little faster because I remember putting it together better. So Vahibi Me Antiochos Melech Yavan. So it happened in, we have a tradition that Vahibi Me introduces some bad things. So bad things happened in the day of Antiochos, the king of Greece. Bishnat Esrim V'Shalosh Shanim L'Malcho, in the 23rd year of his reign, He Shanat Ma'atayim V'Shalosh Esrei Shanim L'Vinyan Beit HaElohim, which is the 123rd year since building the house of God.
13th.
Pardon?
13th.
Oh, Shlosh Esrei, thank you. 113th year since building the house of God. Sam Panav La'alot L'Yerushalayim. He directed his face to go up in a military campaign against Jerusalem. Bayan Vayomer L'Sarav. And he turned around and said to his ministers, "Halo yedatem ki yesh am ha-Yehud, that should be Yehudim, asher b'Yerushalayim b'neinu. There's a Jewish nation in Jerusalem amongst us. Le'eloheinu einam makrivim. They don't sacrifice to our gods. V'dateinu einam osim. They don't follow our religion. V'date ha-melech heim ozevim la'asod datam. They leave aside the imperial religion to follow their own religion. Vagam he miyachalim liyom shivaron hamalachim v'hashiltonim. They are actually praying for the day that we will not rule over them anymore. and they say, v'omerim, matayim loch aleinu malkeinu, v'nishlot bayam u'b'yabasha v'chol ha'olam yinatein v'yadeinu. Right? So when will come the day when our king will rule over us and we will control the heaven and the earth, or the sea and the earth, not the heaven, but the sea, and the entire world will be given in our hands. This is what they're hoping for. Ein kavod l'malchut l'haniach ele al pnei ha'adama. It's not the honor of my imperial self to allow them to remain on the earth. Ata bo v'na'ale alehem. Let's go in a military campaign against them. Unevatel mehem et habirit asher karat lehem. And we'll quash from them or eliminate from them this covenant that they have with God. Shabbat Rosh Chodesh Umilah, which for me is represented in the holidays of Shabbat, Rosh Chodesh, and the rite of circumcision. Vayitav hadavar b'nei sarab v'nei kol chelo. And his ministers and army, they like this. Ve'ota sha'a kam Antiochos hamelech v'yishlach et Nicanor mishnehu b'chayil gadol. So he sent his military governor by the name of Nicanor, the same Nicanor that we saw in Nicanor's day, in a great military host, v'amrav, and lots of people. Vayavo le'ir Yehuda l'Yerushalayim v'yarog b'heragrav. He went to Jerusalem and committed a great massacre. Vayiven Bama, Bebet HaMikdash. He constructed a pagan altar in the Holy of Holies, in the temple in general. B'makom asher amar Elohei Yisrael l'avdav hanaviim. In the particular place that God has commanded the prophets of Israel, Israel, his servants, yeah, the prophets of Israel, to sacrifice. And then I'm editing out most of the Megillah. So there's persecution, there's victory, the Maccabees are the heroes, Nicanor and Bagris and Antiochos are the villains. And then we have the explanation of the miracle, which is basically the same as what's in the Talmud.
Isn't it interesting that this is a very political prompt?
Yeah?
The prompt, the whole, according to Megillas Antiochus, the whole prompt is, this is a rebellious people.
Yes.
Yet they don't follow our gods. But more importantly, they want to overthrow us. They want their own king in place. They want to rule the whole world.
Right.
It's not fundamentally a religious problem they've got with the Jews. It's a political problem.
Exactly. I'm so glad that you brought that up. the problem with, by the way, with preparing too many sources that you end up talking too much. So I love that we had that feedback from Ben. So the last couple of pesukim. Al kein kiyamu b'nei chashmonai kiyum b'chizuku yisar b'nei Yisraeli mehem ke'echad la'asot shmonat hayamim ha'ele yimei mishtev simcha kimei mu'adim haktuvim b'torah. So that's why the Hasmoneans and the children of Israel decided to make these days days of drinking and rejoicing. So again, they focus on the oil as the reason for the drinking and rejoicing. And it says, interestingly, kimei mu'adim haktuvim b'torah, just like the holiday days that are written in the Torah. V'hiligo bahem neirot lehodia asher asa lehem Elohei Hashamayim nitzchum. And this is all about giving recognition to God who acted on their behalf and achieved victory for them. But it does say, u'bahem ein lispod v'lo ligzor tzom, so you shouldn't mourn or you shouldn't eulogize or have a fast day, which is just like what it says in the Gemara. Zulati asher yeh lav neder yishalemenu. But if you have a pass for fasting, if you have made a vow to fast. Achoshmonai ubanav v'achehem lo gazru bahem levatel melacha v'avodah. So even though we've been saying all along that it sounds, looks, and smells very much like a holiday, in fact, you are allowed to do melacha and work on those days. Umin ha'etahi lo haya sham or shem l'malchut Yavan, and that was sort of the that was when the kingdom of Greece jumped the shark, if you will, they were in decline ever since. So basically, what we have in terms of our origin stories of Hanukkah is that, depending on where you look, first of all, it's hard to look in our own sources because we don't have very many. If you look in sources where ancient Jews are talking about it, you tend to either get a military account or you get the oil account.
And here we go.
There are some other sources, like apparently 2 Maccabees is written with a little bit more of a Christian perspective. I didn't have time to bring it because I hardly have time for what I did bring, but you're welcome to look at 2 Maccabees on your own time. So then what we have on the next page is just, we're not going to read these because we all know these texts, but I just wanted to point out that in Birkat HaMazon, the Hanukkah paragraph, and also the Hanerot Halalu statement that is read after we light candles, and in the standard post-Halil completion of the blessing statement that is said by Sephardim when we complete Halil and by Ashkenazim all the time. In all those 3 places that we emphasize the giving of thanks, that various deeds have been performed on our behalf. It's the old saw of they tried to kill us, we won, let's eat, is functionally represented in these, and giving thanks is the theme. All right, now that we've established that, we'll spend a few minutes summarizing what it was that David Solapool said about the origins of Thanksgiving in New York and in America in general. Because, as I said at the beginning, I did want to devote the majority of the shiur to the study of the origins of Hanukkah, I'm not planning to read this completely inside. So what I'll do is give you a little bit of a summary of it quickly and allow you to read the rest or the full account in David Solapool on your own time. Basically, he says that the first time that an American president made a day of Thanksgiving for a national level of Thanksgiving to God was George Washington, our first president. Shortly, 1789 is an important date because why? Anyone? Ratification of the Constitution. So he's celebrating the completion, if you will, of the project begun by declaring independence. And he points out that at various times in history, between Washington and the late 19th century, that there have been times that either the state of New York or a president or someone, the city of New York, will have called in general for religious services of Thanksgiving in which Sherith Israel participated. If we see down in the bottom there, who is reading last? Me. So Ben, why don't you read the italicized piece on the bottom? This is from 1800. In the Ketav Yado, almost, or in his spelling anyway, Gershom Mendes Seishas's explanation of what they actually did for one of these services.
The three first verses of Psalm 95, praise ye the Lord, kolam, etc., chanted as on the festivals. Then the following psalms according to their respective tunes, 30th, 33rd, 34th, 90th, and 91st. The following discourse by the Chazan, prayer for the congregation, a short introductory discourse on the subject of free will offerings to the fund appropriated for private charities, and after the offerings, then the psalm on 67th, 122nd, 124th, and 150th, chanted by the Chazan and Kahal, concluded as on a festival day from all Israel, Vashalom, and peace.
Okay, so what does that sound like?
It sounds like a special service.
Special service, and it's not exactly a Hallel, but it uses a lot of the language and form of Hallel and of the holidays.
The Hallel Adika service.
Exactly.
Well, a lot of the psalms are from the Zemirot.
A lot of the songs are from the Zemirot, and they focus on giving thanks. A lot of them contain the phrase somewhere, give thanks to the Lord. And so basically what he says is that in the early history, you did have Jews giving thanks, although it's interesting that once New York declared Thanksgiving to be a holiday, he does mention that in 1849 and 1854, the synagogues of the city felt constrained to refrain from conducting special services because the governor of the state had addressed his proclamation to a Christian people instead of to Americans of all faiths, which I thought, so mostly Sherith Israel has been on board from the beginning. But not every time. And then meanwhile, in 1863, Abraham Lincoln was trying to refocus national attention on giving thanks. I think it was kind of a plea more for retaining the Union that he declared a national day of Thanksgiving, and it has apparently been observed since October 3rd, 1863. And since we are running out of time, I'm just going to skip into the Thanksgiving issue. So now we know that Thanksgiving originated not as a national holiday, but as a set of isolated Thanksgiving days that then eventually turned into the giving of thanks on a national level, that Sherith Israel at least has participated in them for a long time. And the last thing is that Ben was actually with me 2 years ago on Thanksgiving at Sherith Israel, and they do a Hallel Bidilug Bidilug. Mm-hmm. It's basically the Spanish Portuguese have a way of singing mostly the second part of Hallel out loud. So they take all the parts that are generally sung out loud, and after morning services have completed, they sing the fun part of Hallel as a way of.
With or without a bracha?
It's not with a bracha.
No bracha.
So that we do make a distinction between Likroa Tahalel, which is what we read when we read it Bidilug, and Ligmora Tahalel, which is what we say when we finish it, and there's no bracha, we just read it. But it is it's by putting it directly at the end of services, it's as close to a liturgical reading of these verses as possible. All right, now that we've had that established, that this is the origin of Thanksgiving in America, we can move on to the third and final piece of this shiur, which we'll spend the next 5-ish minutes on. And that has to do with the next time that Thanksgiving would occur. As you can see on the sheet, in 1888, it was recorded to have happened. And again, this year in 2013, due to the way that the Jewish calendar falls out, all the Chagim are very early, and so it is happening again this year. Now, that might lead you to think that the next time that Thanksgiving and Hanukkah would get close to each other would be sometime in the 2130s, given the interval between 1888 and 2013. And there's a columnist named Jonathan Mizrahi who drew attention to the fact that that year, they in fact will not coincide because of a phenomenon known as calendrical drift in the Jewish calendar. And so given that that problem exists, the closest they'll ever get is a day apart instead of coinciding. And unfixed, that problem would get worse and worse and worse, and so they wouldn't coincide again, he said, until 81,056. Now, he wrote this a little whimsically or satirically. I don't think that he meant it to be taken literally, online you will find articles where they do take it literally. I think what he wanted to do was to draw attention to the problem of calendrical drift in the Jewish calendar. So what we'll do is examine a few things from the Wikipedia articles about the Jewish calendars so that we can see what was he talking about. And with that, we will conclude the shiur. So let's read a little bit about what's happening with this. This is the Wikipedia on the Metonic cycle. So Gabe, tell us what the Metonic cycle is.
Okay. Meton of Athens, a 5th century BCE Greek astronomer, observed that a period of 19 years is almost exactly equal to 235 synodic months. The synodic month is the average period of the moon's revolution with respect to the line joining the sun and earth, and 235 synodic months adds up to 6,940 days when rounded to full days. Considering a year to be 1/19th of the 6,940-day cycle gives a year length of 365 plus 1 quarter plus 176 days.
Which is pretty close to a solar year.
Which is slightly more than 12 synodic months. To keep a 12-month lunar year in pace with a solar year, an intercalary 13th month would have to be added on 7 occasions during the 19-year period. 245 equals 19 times 12 plus 7. When Meton introduced the cycle around 432 BC, it was already known by Babylonian astronomers. Traditionally, for the Babylonian Hebrew lunar solar calendars, the year 3, 6, 8, 11, 14, 17, and 19 are the long 13-month years of the Metonic cycle.
So we'll have to say the rest of this outside. But basically, the point is that if you notice that the fraction was 365 days plus 1 quarter plus 176 days, and if you match that up against the actual astronomic length, the fraction, it's 365 plus what fraction, is slightly different. So about every 224 years, you'll find that the Hebrew calendar gets off. So if you do a bunch of Metonic cycles, then you'll find all of a sudden there's a day's discrepancy after 224 years. And given that we've been calculating the Hebrew calendar on a calculational method instead of an observational method for a long time, that we're getting further and further off. So most of the time, given where we are right now, it's okay, and you actually have Pesach falling on or near the spring equinox, except about 20% of the time it's a month late. And so what's going to happen is with this Metonic drift of a day every 224 years, eventually, it will become possible for Pesach to fall at the summer solstice or later. And so this 81,056 date of the next time Thanksgivica would occur is based on the premise that there would be no fix, that the Jewish community would not address the drift of Passover ever, and that you would just keep going on the number of Metonic cycles, until gaining a day again every 224 years, until you came around to 81,056, and it would be back, having cycled through every one of the seasons. So, in fact, God willing, all of humanity should still be around in 80,000 years. I posit that the Jewish community would fix the calendar rather than allow Pesach to fall on or after the summer solstice. And there are various methods for that. You could do, instead of a Metonic cycle in which there's 7 months, you could only do it 6 times. And then instead of being ahead, you'd be behind. And then it could catch up, and you'd have to do that every few thousand years.
The problem is not Chanukah falling on Thanksgiving. The problem is Pesach falling on Thanksgiving.
Right, exactly. No. You really don't
want to have your stuffing then.
Much as we are giving thanks, you really don't want to. I mean, actually, Jonathan Mizrahi doesn't even address Pesach thing. Thanksgiving Esach, or whatever they would call it. So really, I think my claim is that Thanksgivica will occur again sometime much sooner than 80,000 years, but that what it is going to depend on is two things: the continued existence of the United States of America and its holiday of Thanksgiving on the one column, and on the other column, the fact that Jews will need, as a group, to agree in a way that will not actually make a schism. We are all going to get together and surmount our sectarian difficulties and agree on how to change the calendar so that Pesach doesn't fall in the summer. And if we do, and the United States is still around, then there will be a Thanksgivica again before. And
so now that we've established that that's a much more likely outcome than the year 81,056, what is the relationship between the three parts of the shiur that I have laid out so far? I think what all of them share is that it's useful and good and constructive when you do things or when you say things to be able to know what the origin, what the sources are behind the things that we're doing. Ultimately, I think that's the goal of the project of the Keter Shem Tov. What he sought to do in writing the book is to state what the differences are between different groups of Jews in ritual, and then to seriously demonstrate in the text where those behaviors and practices come from. And that's functionally what I think we've done here in looking at the origin stories of Thanksgivica. What we have is the statement in public that Hanukkah and Thanksgiving are related, and that the next time that they will coincide is in 79,000 and change years. That is what everyone hears in the blogosphere and colloquially between people when this subject is being talked about. So what did we do for this shiur? We first looked up what is the origin of Hanukkah and what is it all about. Then we looked up what is the origin of Thanksgiving and what is it all about, so that we could see for ourselves how they are related, if that is true. And then when faced with the allegation that the next time it would occur would not be for something like 80,000 years, we looked into that and determined that there is an interesting problem that happens in the Hebrew calendar that it would be good for all of us to be aware of. And so the next time that we hear the word Thanksgivica, which since it is quite popular, we will definitely be hearing that in the coming weeks, we'll have some more real background about what those issues are. It won't just be something trendy or popular. It will be something that we've studied and that we know a little bit more about than when we started. And I think that's one of the great messages of the Keter Shem Tov, which is that knowing the origin of something is very transformative and positive. It's something that we can feel good about, and it connects us better to the things that we do. And if this one example is something that we could take with us in the rest of our lives, then I think we would all be very happy, and we would be doing a wonderful credit to the memory of the Keter Shem Tov.